Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. We'll be talking to Modern Insurgent today, but first, let's get into some headlines.
I'm going to go first because I think I have the most boring stuff here, but I think it's a general thing that you need to do upkeep on every few months. And Western Europe, a lot of the governments are not doing well over there. Everyone has seen these protests in France over pension reforms and then recently a police shooting. So there's opposition in France, and they've basically been proposing basically France's version of the sixth party system, but it would be a complete rewrite of their government. It would pull power away from the president and put it more into parliament and more voting power in the hands of French citizens, which with I think is a very popular idea right now with popular support. The Dutch government collapsed maybe 2 weeks ago or so, mainly over immigration issues, but it's complicated. Obviously, Britain, I don't know how anyone would support the Conservative Party at this point, but when your opponent is like, Assad didn't gas his own people, I can understand why you would still vote Conservative, even though they can't keep their government together. Then, like, even Spain and Portugal also have some interesting things going on. Portugal is more than likely going to be fine, but all of these things might be affected by the Spanish elections, which are a lot bigger. It even affects Britain because of Gibraltar, which is an economic powerhouse that's owned by Britain, that's technically in Spain, and it was exempt from Brexit. And because everyone hates Brexit, Gibraltar is now tied up in this thing where if the far right won the elections, which spoiler alert, they didn't, they were probably going to try to annex it and basically force Britain out of there. So the left parties basically just got not demolished, they didn't do great in local elections. And for some reason, the president decided to call snap elections because it's one of those governments that decides that that's a democratic thing to do. They were expecting the right to do a lot worse than it did. It didn't do that bad. Technically, there was a stalemate that goes on, but he mainly did it to like unite the left, which worked. And all these individual left parties all came together under an alliance. But what it eventually comes down to is that the deciding factor in the parliament is the Catalan independence movement. So they're definitely going to ask for a referendum as their demand. And if the Spanish president grants that referendum, he'll immediately be able to form the government. Because I think 2 weeks they have an election, and you need an absolute majority to win. So if they negotiate something by then, he'll definitely take it. If they don't, it's just going to end up in a stalemate, and then it's going to go to the next election where you don't need an absolute majority, and he's probably going to win anyway there too. But also, just because Gibraltar and Brexit get involved, it also affects the reintegration of Northern Ireland, because anything involving Brexit complicates the process there. But if Catalan independence referendum comes up, you can probably expect a referendum to also gain popular support in Northern Ireland. So Western Europe might potentially shake up mainly the entire world democracy at this point, because America, I don't know what's going to happen here. I'm still predicting the GOP is going to collapse after this election. So it might inspire a lot more collapses if everything in Europe keeps failing the way it is.
It might. I just don't see Catalonia getting that, because they have Barcelona, and Barcelona is like the only thing people go to in Spain. So like that's a massive money draw for them, which is a boon for Catalonia. That's my sort of hesitations there.
The Catalonia government, well, the parliamentary seats, basically, I think it's the Junta, said that their priority is going to be Catalonia, not Spain. So they didn't even say they're going to propose a referendum. I'm just guessing that's going to happen, which a lot of people are.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. a non-violent way that they can kind of avoid fighting. I think that's their best route to go.
You can always get rid of the government in a violent way.
Yeah, speaking of getting rid of the government in a violent way, the West African nation of Niger, there were reports that the presidential guard had basically locked and prevented the president, democratically elected president Mohamed Bazoum, in his presidential palace, and that they basically just held him there, and they blocked off a bunch of ministry buildings that were near the presidential palace, stopped any staff from accessing their offices and things like that, and basically what appeared to be a coup, and has been, as far as we can tell, a successful coup. The Niger military announced that they would be basically taking over the government from here on out. They cited like some issues with insurgency groups, economic problems, and they just kind of what they saw as an overall failure from Mohamed Bazoum's government to kind of keep order going. The new guy in charge, his name is Abdurrahman Tishani. Essentially, France, the United Nations, the U.S., and the ECOWAS, which is basically like an economic coalition of West African countries. It includes Nigeria, it includes Mali, it includes Ghana, Benin, some of those, just a bunch of West African nations, essentially. They've all strongly condemned it, and ECOWAS, which has basically said that they will take all measures to try and help restore the democratic rule in Niger. And that can include the use of force. So what a use of force would entail, I'd assume it'd mean that these countries' militaries put boots on the ground or something. But again, that seems to me like I'm not really trying to state my opinion here, but we've seen no indication of that happening yet. It's just an option that they've laid out on the table, more or less. It's kind of what's going on right now, is it seems that the military in Niger has led a successful coup against Mohamed Bazoum, and obviously this concerns people, because a year ago Burkina Faso did the same thing, and they've more or less become closer allies with Russia in 2020 and 2021. Mali did the same thing, and they've become a lot closer with Russia. They kicked French troops out of the country, and Niger was kind of seen as like, Niger under the government of Bazoum was kind of seen as like this last Western ally in the Sahel region of Africa. So again, it's kind of just an unfortunate situation going on in one of the poorest countries in the world, and on top of that, a country that is dealing with like a raging number of Islamist insurgencies.
How is this going to affect terrorism in the region, do you think?
The way I see it, just in my opinion, I could just see, you know, whoever the certain Islamist insurgencies, drug traffickers, things of that nature, just taking advantage of the current chaos that's going on and basically just, you know, increasing operations possibly. I'm not entirely sure, but that's what I see happening in the not so far future, is that they'll just kind of take advantage of the chaos and do what they need to do. People have, you know, sort of insinuated or analyzed that they might go look to Russia and the Wagner group for security things, kind of the way Mali has, for example. Again, we haven't seen anything
like that yet. If Wagner's pulling out of Ukraine, you know, Ukraine, they could be down there.
It could open up that possibility. We haven't really seen anything like that yet, but it could open up that possibility. It's a messed up situation all around. A lot of the military leaders who supported the coup basically said that they wanted to avoid like a potential confrontation, which could have led to like in the quote of one army chief, a bloodbath. So again, kind of track back to 4 days ago when it seemed that it was just the presidential guard that was involved in this, and that the army might have stepped in. It seems as though they just came to some kind of mutually beneficial agreement where the military could now be in charge under this new guy, Abdurrahman Tishani. So a few key points I would like to key on is there are still French troops, members of the French military who are stationed in Niger, and there are two U.S. military bases in the country as well. And some of the officers involved in the coup were trained by, received some training from the U.S. military. So what you make of that is up to you, but that's just the thing that we should point out. The other thing we should point out is that Niger accounts for about 5% of the world's uranium exports. And according to some estimates that I can't really confirm, they account for France, 50% of the uranium that they use in like nuclear reactors and things like that comes from Niger. So
you think even Russian gas could tie into this?
Do I think Russian gas could tie into it?
Yeah, they want to limit the uranium, so more people have to rely on Russian gas.
It could. That's also an interesting thing. Yeah, but as of now, the situation as it is, it appears that the military is in charge. The U.S. and France obviously have, in the UN, have strongly condemned this coup. And it looks like the ECOWAS coalition of West African states, primarily headed by Nigeria, Ghana, are saying that the use of force is not out of the question to kind of, I don't know what, restore order. But as far as the status of Mohamed Bazoum, he is currently, I believe he is still locked up in the presidential palace with his wife and his son, and his daughters are in Paris.
They were saying they were going to execute him if he didn't come up with the money that he spent or something.
The video you're referring to, that was a video that got spread around a lot. You'll see the video of this guy. He's like crying at a podium.
Yes, that's what I saw.
And they're saying that's a financial minister who is saying that it's related to the coup, that like the military basically told him he has 48 hours to come up with like some amount of money that he lost or like embezzled, or he'll be executed. That video is like 2 years old. It's basically I think it was a finance minister, some government official in Niger crying because they lost their job. And I believe this guy's still alive. So that video that's getting spread around, it's an old video from 2 years ago. It has nothing to do with the current coup.
So definitely information warfare ops going around this as well, which also points to Russia. And then also, Jack, if you want to get into, I don't know, we're going to talk about how the grain is linked to this even.
No. I wasn't doing that. I was going to talk about the...
you were going to talk about the Russia-Africa summit?
Yeah. The Russia-Africa summit, mostly Russia forgiving debt, which is very interesting. On the other side of Africa, in the Horn. So Russia gave about $700 million worth of debt relief to Somalia, which is kind of big because...
That's good. I don't care
if it is good.
It is good,
but it's just from what I've read, it seems like this could significantly reduce Somalia's debt and maybe allow them to get back up on their feet. Which is all around a good thing considering how unstable Somalia has been. But it's also a bit of a worry because it would probably do some soft power favors for Russia as well. But on the topic of debt relief, China has been doing the same thing. China has given relief to around 17 African nations that took interest-free loans, I'm assuming through the Belt and Road Initiative. Which is very interesting because most of these loans, when they're not forgiven, China just takes the land from underneath and is like, hey, this is ours now. You know, we shipped over workers and you got nothing from the economy, so we're taking the land as well. So this is very interesting. And it's not the first time they've done this, but it is a significant amount. And loans, from what I've read, from anywhere from $8 million through to $600 million loans. So... Again, this is good. Like, this is not a criticism or anything. This is a good thing because less debt going around in African nations is honestly a good thing, especially with the way that the population is. There's a high risk of the male population going one of two ways. So economic stability is one way to avoid this, I believe. So it's just very interesting that all this debt relief is coming around right now, just after COVID's pretty much over. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, it's like they people overestimate the what totalitarian shit is going to happen. But like, ultimately, at the end of the day, China doesn't own these countries. So if they fuck them over with their debt traps, they're still getting a propaganda victory by relieving debt. By now, you know, now the 50th Army can say, hey, look, we're not doing debt traps. We relieved this debt because we care about these nations, which then, you know, makes the leaders in those nations more supportive of China, because they, as long as you, you know, as long as you pull the knife out just a little bit when you're stabbing them in the back, they'll think that you're doing something good from them, you know? And like, this was like, I think Malcolm X said this about liberals. And that's basically just kind of what you could equate to what these things happen with African nations. But Africa is way more important than people realize, which is just, it's crazy how important it is. It's so underestimated.
Like, if, especially if they form these unions that they've been looking at, they'll definitely have some level of power in the global stage, which is good considering the last, 500 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, speaking of militant groups, here's our interview with Modern Insurgent. This is mainly Ace doing this interview while I'm pulling up visuals. Great interview, just going through different militant groups that are undercover throughout the world. And then Modern Insurgent also just released a documentary. Do you know what this one that they just released is, Ace?
Yeah, it's a collection of footage from foreign fighters in the YPG during the Siege of Manbij, I believe.
And then we talked to them about, they just shot a documentary in Nepal that they're going to be releasing soon. We'll probably have them on again shortly, which will be an episode that, you know, because we shoot a month ahead, so even if we have them on shortly, it'll be way down the road. So anyway, here's our interview with Modern Insurgent.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
My name is Antoine. I'm from France and Serbia. I'm 19 years old and I'm the founder of Modern Insurgent. We are an independent organization, a media organization that focuses specifically on rebel groups, different insurgencies around the world. And we produce articles, documentaries, podcasts, now a podcast. So exciting to be here and thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming on. Were you the one who was just recently in Nepal?
Yep. I filmed our first on-the-ground documentary in Nepal. So I had the privilege of going there with my university for a sort of like sponsored trip. Mm. And while everyone was shopping in the last 2 days, I took the opportunity to film something.
That's something I would do for sure.
We're really excited for that documentary to release. So that'll be fun.
Thank you. And yeah, you guys have been supporting us since day one when it was just like posting pretty bad posts on Instagram. So
dude, I really like your map.
You guys have had like
neat feature.
Really good production value from the start. It's just kind of like, it was a good concept. I think the thing is like with our little corner of Instagram, there's a lot of like terms and groups that get thrown around. And it's like, me personally, when I'm trying to write, I always try to give as much background as I can. It's kind of good that you guys have made that your thing, that you're like just telling us what everything is. It's just a good informative tool. It's like if you were wanted to read the news and actually understand what was going on, just a lot easier. They could easily go to your page and just read a couple posts and they'd be like, okay, so when I'm reading about Syria, I know more now. So it's just like, it's really just very educational in my opinion.
For sure. Yeah, thanks. That's the whole point, you know, focusing on the really small scale. So then eventually it gives you a broader understanding.
So speaking about focusing on small scale stuff, I think we have a few small scale things here. You want to start with the Free Papua movement?
There's quite a few interesting groups around the world. And, you know, one of the main ones we really like to cover are very small and niche movements that, you know, almost no one's heard about. And this is an interesting one. When we discovered it, we actually reached out to some experts. And not many people knew much about the Free Papua movement. But basically, it's a general independence movement, if you call it like that, for the territory of West Papua. So now, you know, if we're speaking about international recognition, the territory isn't recognized at all. It belongs constitutionally to Indonesia, and it's at the border with Papua New Guinea. And the group itself is really interesting because it's an armed independence movement. And it, you know, most of their weapons are very sort of old weapons, or they even fight with bows and arrows.
Yeah,
and
they've been in the news lately for hostages. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Yep, they actually took a journalist hostage, if I remember correctly. And they basically said if you
a guy from New Zealand,
negotiations,
right?
Yep. And they basically said, you know, if you don't cooperate with us or fulfill our demands, we'll kill him. So it's a very violent independence organization that interestingly has a lot of support in Southeast Asia. A lot of people reached out to us saying, thank you so much for covering these guys, full solidarity behind them. And yeah, they just fight against Indonesia because they want to, you know, have their own territory. They view themselves as ethnically and just nationally different to Indonesian people. Yeah, I see you have a picture up there, so you can see the very antique weapons they have. And that's the journalist that they kidnapped not too long ago.
The origins of the group, how far do they go back? Like the 60s, the 70s? Because that's kind of the time when the Dutch started transferring sovereignty to Indonesia. So around...
It's absolutely... It dates back to the 60s when the Netherlands was giving out the territory. It was actually created in 1963. And the OPM attempted dialogue, diplomatic dialogues with Indonesia and the international community. And since then, it's been doing a lot of nationalistic ceremonies. So you can find videos of that online as well. Sometimes they film themselves. You have journalists covering it. And if I'm not mistaken, the journalist from New Zealand, that's what he actually wanted to film. They have these sort of mass protests where they walk through different parts of Indonesia in their traditional clothing, and they start praising their own territory of West Papua. And so the West Papua territory was assigned to Indonesia through the New York Agreement, which was in 1963. In 1963. But West Papua already had its own anthem, its rituals, its coat of arms. They even had their own coat of arms since 1961. So they were envisioning independence before the partition of that territory, and then it was assigned to Indonesia. So they had that very, if you can call it proto-nationalism, that's usually the academic term we refer to that, the very beginnings of nationalism before it was given to Indonesia. So in more colloquial terms, you know, if in 1963 your land is given to Indonesia, you can understand why they were sort of motivated, or they had that sense of anger with that situation, which is why since they've been doing their acts of rebellions, and Indonesia is the only country in the world actually who recognizes the OPM as a terrorist organization. And that's mostly because they're the only ones who view them as a real security risk. In recent years, this is more of a personal observation, there's been a lot of discontent with the politics of Indonesia. And so people have sort of, as we see usually within political, sort of, let's say, political support, you know, if the enemy of my enemy becomes my friend. So a lot of people who sort of oppose the Indonesian government would inadvertently start supporting the OPM as well.
So from my understanding, is a big part of the reason Indonesia is so keen on holding on to West Papua for, I guess, as long as they reasonably can, is due to mining resources mostly, or is it a different type of like resource expedition?
You're absolutely right. It's mostly because of resources, but it's also because Indonesia just has that strategic interest in not only conceding the land. They've had a lot of separatist movements in the past and sort of opposition. Right. And they know that, for example, if you concede to that one, then it can lead to a chain of events. But in terms of their real interest, it's really mostly about preserving the resources they have there. If I'm not mistaken, they also have a lot of logging activities there. So they profit from that. It's a big economic incentive for them to maintain that land.
I think it's important you pointed that out, just because Indonesia in general, even like West Papua is a bit of an extreme example when we look at it, but almost every island that makes up Indonesia is culturally distinct. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, in like your like research and looking into the Free Papua movement, do they ever target these like mining or logging operations, or do they ever target like mining infrastructure, things like that?
So they do it in a bit of an unconventional way. There's some reports. We finally most these through open source intelligence. There's a few sort of videos that circulate online where we can see them doing illegal mining. So what they tend to do is, instead of just attacking those places directly, they kind of leverage what profits they can gain from them. So you'll see them doing some illegal mining activities from here and there. But from reports, I'm not sure if they've actually fully attacked one of those, let's say, mines or so before.
Right.
Which is
a common, I'm sure, as you figured out at this point, just like insurgent strategy, is when you can't really, you know, have an actual economy, is you start illegal logging, illegal mining, illegal sale of drugs, etc., to finance your activities.
What do you think is next for this movement? Do they have like much success of maintaining their goals? Are their strategies effective? Are they just getting crushed by colonialism?
Well, it's a bit of a tough one to predict fully, because at the same time, they had a big momentum, especially in 2019, because 43 students were protesting for the independence of West Papua. They were protesting in favor of the OPM, and they were all arrested. So after that, there was a bunch of people who were supporting the OPM, and it was gaining real momentum. And then since the war, we've had that drastic loss of support where people are just questioning why they're supporting Russia and stuff like that. And now, especially with the kidnapping of the journalist, it seems the reputation has almost, you know, flipped upside down. So in terms of what the future has to hold, it seems their actions are just getting more and more violent. And traditionally, if we're talking about, you know, reputation, that's not ideal for a group that was relatively underreported beforehand, because now it's being in the spotlight, but for somewhat the wrong reasons. So if I had to take a guess, I would most likely say that the Indonesian effort, the extent to which they're going to crack down on the movement, is only going to increase in the next few months.
Because the one thing I've noticed from West Papua, and just like observing it maybe in the last like year or two, is there have been attacks launched by the Free Papua movement against just Indonesian soldiers in the area, or, you know, ones that are on patrol, etc. Seems like, it seems like if anything, all it's going to take is like one more, you know, skirmish where five or six Indonesian soldiers are killed, and they might launch a full-scale operation. But that's just kind of some armchair analysis.
I think it's a valid observation. I mean, this is a bit unrelated, but I think it's worth for the anecdote. For example, in New Caledonia, there's also a separatist movement. They had this big incident where they had kidnapped multiple French police officers to try and put out a statement, but that just led to over 20 deaths. The military reprisal by France was huge. And so I think here we'll get that same situation. You called it an armchair analysis, but I think it's a pretty valid concern that they might eventually try and do an act of resistance that's maybe beyond their reach.
Was this in the 80s by chance?
The one in New Caledonia was in the 80s, if I recall correctly anyway. So it's the Kanaki and Socialist National Liberation Movement. I think that's the full name of the group, if I got that correct. And they had an incident where, they tried to kidnap and even kill some French police officers, and that just led to complete chaos. And so then France sent its military to crack them down. So I think potentially that might happen with the OPM. They might try and kidnap some Indonesian military officers or something similar. And then,
what were their demands for this Australian hostage?
I think, if I recall correctly, at first it was just directly gaining independence, I think.
Okay.
And then they revised it. Then they revised it into a money demand.
If they're just grabbing random tourists and holding them ransom for money, that might be like an effective harassment and help you fund yourself strategy.
Actually, you know, the Indonesian government isn't very keen on doing much to help the journalist, because West Papua is one of, if not perhaps in the top five most difficult zones to go in as any journalist. Even the UN has a sort of, I wouldn't call it a warrant, I'm not sure what the right word is. They have a sort of notice that journalists shouldn't even try and go to West Papua. So now, you know, they can kind of use that to say, oh, well, it was his own fault for trying to adventure there.
They say that there might be a Tasmanian tiger still here. Like, that's how unexplored and dense this jungle is, you know?
Yeah, it's a big jungle environment. Who knows? Maybe the Loch Ness monster was there all along. We were looking in the wrong place.
Yeah, you're just going to see it off the coast one day as you're getting kidnapped.
Kind of a similar group over in Myanmar. We have a lot of interesting folks there.
You know, Myanmar is an interesting one because they have so many groups against the junta. And what's really, really unique about them is the vast majority of them, you'll see an incredible, overwhelming involvement of students. And as a student myself, it's honestly incredible to see sometimes. And in Myanmar, you'll see a lot of footage through open source intelligence. You'll see a lot of videos.
This is just what Wikipedia has listed for the amount of groups. That's the largest I've ever seen, you know?
Yeah. And there's still the offshoots from them. There's actually groups that started splintering back. So they were active back in the day, and now they're coming back from the Chinese border. So I think the list is even longer than what Wikipedia shows. But yeah, the amount of students doing those acts of resistance is absolutely remarkable, if, even from a neutral perspective, whether you agree with them or you don't. It's just remarkable to see so many students uniting against what they view as their, you know, singular cause. And I think the main one people talk about is the Myanmar People's Defense Force, the PDF. They gained a lot of attention, especially sort of in our Instagram, you know, sort of corner, the community of open source intelligence, independent journalism, because there's been a lot of coverage on their use of 3D weapons, the internet, those kind of very contemporary approaches. And that's partly why they've been so successful in their fight against the junta. You know, there's this sort of old expression, if I may use it for anecdote, just for the purpose of it, that most dictatorships or governments are led by very old men. And certainly with the junta, that's almost certainly true. And they have a very hard time keeping up with the modern approaches that those groups use. They have, I mean, their communication networks by themselves could have an entire dissertation, an entire thesis written on them. They communicate in ways that the Burmese government can't even begin to understand. So it's really interesting. And the PDF itself doesn't only have students. You see, there's groups that are purely students. For example, the All Burma Students Democratic Association, if I'm not mistaken, or Democratic Organization, if I recall correctly. The gun he's holding is an FGC9, which stands for Fuck Gun Control 9. Pardon my French. That's the name of the gun anyway. And it's a sort of patent that you can find online to make these guns. And so you see an incredible amount of them being used in Myanmar especially. But yeah, the PDF is such an interesting group, especially because they generally do push for democratic ideals, and they were birthed 2 years ago. They really, right after Myanmar fell to that coup d'etat in 2021, and when they overthrew the NDL, the National League for Democracy, yeah, the NDL in Myanmar, they instantly formed. I mean, they felt the need to protect their people, and a bunch of students came together as well and just joined the PDF. And so you'll see very young people. I mean, obviously, I'm only 19, so they might be a bit older than me, but still very, very young at the leadership positions of that group. Really, really fascinating stuff. And the PDF has by far been the most influential stakeholder in the fight against the junta. Like I said, you have a lot of other groups. Yeah, the PDF has by far been the most influential one.
One thing about Myanmar, just to track it back to what you were saying, as someone who doesn't really like know much about navigating blocked internet, if you just look at, you know, the NetBlocks website and you see where internet is blacked out, it's often in Myanmar, and the fact that they can have as much outreach as they do and you find them online as often as you do, it's very impressive. And like you were saying about the young people, it seems like every time you're looking at, you know, a video out of Myanmar, especially from the PDF, be it like a firefight or them manufacturing weapons or whatever, you do look at them and you're like, this guy looks like he's like 17, 18. Like, yeah. You know, they don't look very old. You're like, it seems like the only group where I kind of see like the combatants are usually like a little older is the Karenni. They're one of the few groups out in Myanmar where it's like, when I see videos, I'm like, okay, that guy looks like he could be in his 30s or something, in late 20s.
Yeah. I just want to say something real quick about communication. Their videos, like if you analyze a lot of their videos, you just have to look at them with your eyeballs and compare them to Ukraine. They mirror a lot of like Ukraine style, and it looks like they've studied Ukraine's videos and how Ukraine is doing things. Because, I mean, that's one of the main poles of influence probably Ukraine has had, is just the constant putting out of information. Oh, yeah. If it wasn't a jungle, you wouldn't be able to tell a lot of stuff apart. And if the guys weren't in flip-flops, you know, there's conditions. But
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, the flip-flops is a really good point. I think, you know, as informal as it is, I think it's important noting that unlike other warfare movements where you see they have traditional outfits, I mean, even the OPM we were talking about, they have their traditional clothing, a very unique style to them. When you look at the PDF or even the All Burma Students Association, the vast majority of them are just running around shooting in jeans and flip-flops. And it just adds to that weird aesthetic of the Burmese conflict that's so unique. And it's quite interesting dynamics as well, because you have such a wide gap between the capabilities of the Tatmadaw and then those groups. And yet the fight is still going on. It's really interesting to explore that.
Is it a country that's just destined to just be in a state of civil war?
Well, The truth is, even when the NDL was there, the National League for Democracy, they still had reprisal against the Rohingya population in the south. So even the highest standard of democracy we've seen in Myanmar of all time had still that internal conflict with certain minorities in the south that they were just forcefully trying to expel from the country. So people often blame that state of instability on poor leadership, dictatorships. But you'll see that many scenarios, the reason as to why there's so much conflict traces back all the way back to the partition of those territories. I mean, the way we, you know, the West, once it was decolonizing, gave back Indochina and Southeast Asia was in a way that really didn't reflect any of the ethnic or cultural sort of guidelines there at all. And so now you see those weird scenarios, I think, in Cambodia, in Laos, especially in Myanmar, where you have so much diversity that was never historically together and under one state, and now they're sort of forced to be put together. So I wouldn't say they're, let's be hopeful, you know, let's be optimistic. I wouldn't say that they're forever in a state of civil war, but I certainly don't think they got lucky with their circumstances and their conditions.
Something I did want to ask is who is supporting the Burmese military government? Who's their main funders? Who's selling them weapons? Who's backing them essentially?
Well, the truth is, it's, you know, usually I'm very careful about labels like this that are sort of sensationalist. But I think for Myanmar, it's completely true. It's been a forgotten conflict. It really hasn't been. I mean, if you look at country support, no one supports the military, but then no one also supports the rebel groups. It's just kind of, we left it there. And you see that a lot of the times, even the rebel groups are asking for funding, they're asking for help. And sometimes you see the West show some hints of like, oh yeah, we care, but nothing's ever done to help either side. And in terms of the military's, you know, the Tamadaw, the let's say the dictatorship, the junta's allies, I'm not sure at all if there's any country that's explicitly very open about supporting them, in my knowledge anyway. It's really just a forgotten conflict.
So also, just because there's no funding coming in, Myanmar is like number two in growing heroin behind Afghanistan. I guess if we're to believe the Taliban, it's number one now. So yeah. How is that coming in? Who's gaining from that? Is it all sides gaining from the poppy trade, or is it just one-sided?
So yeah, kind of, you know, what we were talking about earlier, it's sort of to their own benefits, rebel groups will hijack the resources they have. So we do see a lot of that trade coming in with heroin. But actually, I've heard that the Taliban have started cutting down on the extent to which they're trading those. Whether it's the opium poppy seeds or just direct production of heroin, they're cutting down on it a lot. So I wouldn't even be surprised if Myanmar is number one now in the world. Now, I haven't heard reports that the junta is directly profiting from it, but I'm sure both sides are. I think that's a really fair assumption to say.
No, something I did want to ask you about is kind of a group that seems to have almost faded into obscurity, for better or for worse, especially given what's happened to the people that they, you know, quote unquote, represent. The Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army. Are they still active? Have you seen anything from them? Do we know what they're up to? Are they more so, you know, because you're dealing with, you know, a majority Muslim region here, are they more so trying to protect the Rohingya people, or do they have like a more Islamist motive, etc.?
I think now especially, I mean, during the days of the National League, the NDL, the Democratic Party that was in power in Myanmar before the junta overthrew it, it was quite active. Most of their actions, if I remember correctly, started in 2016, 2017. And they were really active. But since the Tamadaw kind of took over, they haven't been incredibly active. They were sort of fighting in 2021. But this year, I think they had I remember seeing this somewhere, they had a clash in a refugee camp. And so now they've sort of been a dispersed organization. One thing I do know for a fact about that group is they've had a lot of internal disputes. There was a very unclear structure. People were always fighting for positions of leadership. And that just caused sort of the movement to, I guess, what became the situation they're in this year. So kind of not fully dormant, but when they are active, it's not incredibly efficient attacks or approaches. I mean, they just had clashes in refugee camps, which isn't ideal for their cause.
Right. Were any of the refugee camps where they had clashes in Bangladesh, or was it all within Myanmar? Because I remember vaguely hearing something about.
Yeah, I think it was. Oh, I think it might have been at the border. To be honest, I think it might have been at the border, but you're right. It had something to do with Bangladesh. So I think it might have been one of the refugee camps in Bangladesh, because Bangladesh is obviously taking a few of them in. So.
Well, if you want to keep talking about a group and a country in particular where insurgent groups love using resources to fund their operations, why don't we get into the March 23rd movement, or M23, in the DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo. They, from my understanding, is they claim to advocate for Tutsis. If you know your history, right, the Tutsis were the subject of a genocide in Rwanda in the 90s, and they claim to advocate for Congolese Tutsis, so basically Tutsi people in the Congo, and it is they've been supported by Rwanda. And just recently, actually, there's been a UN report that comes out that's basically saying, like, yeah, despite whatever exactly the Rwandan government might say, we've quote unquote independently verified that they are being supported by the Rwandan government. And France just came out like 2 or 3 days ago, I believe, saying, condemning like Rwanda's quote unquote like ongoing support for the M23 movement.
Yeah, and you know, usually when we talk about rebel movements, especially with the work we do at Modern Insurgent, we really focus on impartiality and we really focus on trying not to get too political. But with the M23 movement, it's generally almost impossible, just because the entire backing of the group is dependent on sort of political opinion. I mean, it's really incredible. The group itself wasn't even destined to become, let's say, an insurgency as such. There was, the name of the group is M23 stands for the 23rd of March, because in 2009, there was a peace accord signed with the Democratic Republic of Congo, their government, and with the National Congress for the Defense of the People, which was another chaotic, let's say, situation for the DRC, as we've seen in forever, really. And so that agreement legitimized the CNDP as a political party. So they were sort of an insurrection before, and through that agreement, they became an actual political party in the DRC. And that meant that the M23 rebels, who was, you know, the military wing of that political party, were now part of the national army. So it's a bit like what we see with the completely different example, but still somewhat valid, with the Azov battalion becoming an Azov regiment. So the M23 rebel movement fully became integrated within the DRC's army. But then 3 years later, in 2012, the DRC's government backstabbed the M23, and they signed a peace agreement that ousted the M23 from the entire national army. And so since then, obviously, the members of the M23 rebels have completely become mutineers. They've started fighting back against the DRC. And they were mostly based in the northeast, or just in the east, not in the northeast, in the east of the DRC, in Goma and North Kivu. And here's where things get even more complicated for the DRC, is that there are huge reports. I mean, we're talking about huge reports. We're talking about what you mentioned, literally the UN press release and the UN's independent investigations and their findings, that the M23 has, I'll say allegedly, just you know, to keep that possibility open, allegedly almost completely been supported by the Rwandan government. And the reports come from the quite simple observation that many of them had the Rwandan flag strapped on the side of their outfits. I think obviously it doesn't get much clearer than that, but we still have to keep in mind that Rwanda technically denies the support, even though the entire international community is telling Rwanda to stop doing it. Rwanda has a big interest in funding the M23s.
That's what I was going to ask next. I was curious about both governments' motivations. Not only why is Rwanda funding them, but why did the army join them and then just to kick them out later? Did the army think that they had advantage and they could take them out, and that's why they kicked them out? Like, what's going on there?
So I'll answer them in the same order. The reason as to why Rwanda supports them is quite straightforward. They have a lot of interest in the North Kivu region. It's one of the most mineral-rich areas of the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's even reports, I mean, just to give you an idea of how complex this gets, there's even reports that Rwanda has signed contracts with the Chinese, let's say, companies for territory and mines in the North Kivu region of the DRC. If those reports are true, that would obviously be a breach of international law. You have Rwanda trying to sign agreements with China in a territory that's not theirs. And so you have Rwanda getting that benefit from the resources in North Kivu. Then the reason as to why the M23 got kicked out of the National Army is somewhat unclear. It's sort of the unpredictability, irrationality that we've seen in the Congolese government's history in the last, I don't know how many years, let's say 30 years. The main reason why would certainly be, let's say, a regime change, the DRC, and also just because a lot of the people, actually, this is also a main argument to make, a lot of the fighters for the M23, once they were included in the National Army, refused to fight for the army because of what Ace mentioned at the start. They sort of present themselves as, well, that's perhaps not the spokespeople, but the fighters people for the Tutsis in the DRC. And so now that they were within the National Army, they had that split of ideologies. Even though the peace agreement was signed, they didn't believe in anything that the DRC was doing. And so there was internal feud, and then the government decided to cut them off.
I think just from like a logistical perspective, it is similar kind of to what's happening in Sudan right now. Anytime you try to integrate a non-state actor or an insurgent group into a national military, at least from what we've seen so far in Sudan, the DRC, just the two examples we're using right now, it doesn't seem to work out very well, because insurgent groups, obviously, just from a tactical perspective, operate very differently from a traditional army. There's also a thousand other reasons depending on where you're talking about. And I do find it interesting because, as we know, a huge reason that so many rebel groups are able to sustain themselves and fight for as long as they have in the DRC is because of resources. So I think, as we've seen in Rwanda, there's a big kind of kick by the president there, Paul Kagame, to improve infrastructure and, you know, increase their economic standing, et cetera. And I think, you know, not to get too kind of tinfoil hatty here, but the thing is that if they can gain access to mines in Kivu, in the east of the country, they can better fund whatever economic ambitions they may have, that being the Rwandan government. And M23 is kind of like a vessel for them to do that, right? Sort of how the RSF is a vessel for gold smuggling in the UAE or for Russia.
There's also the Central African Republic. The conflict is kind of stupid there, but one of the main things that was going on in the conflict is that Wagner built the largest gold mine and then rebels just took it and held it for the longest time. Like, I think Wagner might have it back now. I'm not sure. I don't follow it. It's like, but if that's all it was, is just them holding a gold mine that Wagner built. It's all these African conflicts have been about lately is gold.
But to kind of emphasize a couple key points, according to a lot of reports, the M23 movement is responsible for approximately, let's say, 20% of all like incidents of political violence in the country, which it's like, if you know about the DRC and you know about just the number of groups that are active there, from like CODECO to Islamist groups, et cetera, that is a very significant number of events or a percentage of events to be responsible for, especially given how violent these attacks and like kind of massacres, so to speak, can be in the country. The other thing is you were saying that they had found M23 soldiers with Rwandan flag patches on their uniforms and whatnot. And I remember I was following this very closely when a lot of the accusations against Rwanda were getting thrown around last year, and I wrote a little bit about it, but the Congolese army had claimed, like, we, you know, had literally told Rwanda, we have two or three officers, I believe, at some point last year from your army, and we have their names, and we know for sure that they're Rwandan. And they like gave the Rwanda government, these are the names, this is their rank, et cetera. And the Rwanda government was just like, nah, that's not our guys. It's not us. They were like, dude, these guys have like names. They have like Rwandan ID cards. They have like ranks and everything. And Rwanda's just like, not our guys, which is kind of weird to think about. On the one hand, you gotta just, obviously Rwanda's trying to deny any involvement, but you've also got to feel for the two or three Rwandan soldiers who may have been captured, because it's like, at that point, Rwanda is not advocating for your release or trying to negotiate anything at all, because any negotiation of your release would be admitting to funding M23 and being involved in the conflict in the Congo.
For sure.
Which they categorically deny.
And also, I'd like to add, if possible, I remember I was trying to look for this online and I just couldn't find anything anymore. I remember, it must have been at least a month now, there were these plans or these theories that there were this coalition of six countries. I think it was the DRC, Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, Mozambique, and maybe another, that wanted to unify into one country. I'm not sure if you saw those.
The East African Federation, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
We've talked about it a little bit on this show, yeah.
The thing is, that would be absolutely impossible to even think about, given that so many of these countries are involved in backing certain rebel groups in the DRC. And so it's always interesting when I see, you know...
I think you'll see it in Kenya and Rwanda first, if anything. It's going to appear Kenya, Rwanda first, and then we'll see what happens from there. But they do have, like, infrastructure projects that they're funding together, like... I think they are funding a new pipeline through South Sudan to cut off Sudan's oil refinery.
Yeah, there was also one in, I think it was called a DERG project, D-E-R-G. Maybe I'm mistaken a bit. But yeah, similar, like huge pipelines, huge infrastructures. Those countries tend to help each other that way. But they haven't helped the DRC as much. That has to be admitted.
Right. And it kind of just speaks to, I guess you could say, like the... quote unquote, like tragedy of the geography of the DRC is they have all these resources. They have an insane amount of land, but they have no ports. So ultimately, just because of political instability and just because of their own geography, they become like sort of a breeding ground for, you know, interests and different groups who want to take these resources and then send them somewhere with a port where they can import, export, and ultimately, you know, none of the money is being invested back into the Congolese people. It's either going back into, you know, political figures' pockets, or it's going back into funding rebel groups who are terrorizing the populace. It's just the whole situation in that country is just very, very like tragic.
So this is mostly an opinion, I will admit. This doesn't have anything to do with sort of the things we do at the modern city. This is just my observations, especially from the work I do at university. I've noticed a lot that usually if a country has experienced a lot of harm, or let's say, as we've seen in Rwanda, genocide, countries, especially in the West, will be more lenient on punishing those countries for the crimes they do today. And I draw that observation mostly from Rwanda and Israel as well. You know, those two countries have clearly had a lot of debatably questionable activities, whether it's to do with the whole Palestine question, or obviously once again with Rwanda with the M23 rebels, but we don't seem to be punishing them or putting sanctions on them. And it's almost as if that guilt of the Rwandan genocide, the Second World War with the Holocaust still remains today. And that's why many of the countries don't want to punish those states. And from my own perspective, obviously, it's just the rhetorical question of, let's say, the DRC was funding a rebel group in Rwanda, how would the entire plot change? You know, and I think that's an interesting observation to make. And I think a lot of the times these countries get away with the stuff they do because we still have that stigma. And of course, there's a big political, especially in terms of power play, there's a whole political incentive as to why Western countries don't want to punish Rwanda as much. Rwanda has sort of become the Western hotspot of the, let's say, southern half of Africa. Paul Kagame, he's managed to get Rwanda out of poverty, but that's obviously been to the profit of sometimes the West, but now mostly China as well.
Right. And the thing with Kagame that you bring up is he has kind of curated this image as the benevolent, like authoritarian, exactly. Where he's like seen as like, okay, he's not, you know, obviously the best guy in terms of human rights and whatnot, but he lifted a country that like what? 30 years ago was like in a complete state of disrepair, civil war, genocide, etc. And he's built them up to like one of the, you know, if we're looking at Africa, it's one of the premier like economies in Africa, and it's one of the kind of just places where people want to do business. And he's done a lot for the infrastructure there, etc. So again, like you just said, it does come down to like leniency because of whatever economic or social benefit is seen as having Kagame rule over the country.
Well, it's also not our place to just be overthrowing people.
You know? Oh no, I'm not suggesting we overthrow anybody.
We tried that with Saddam, and it didn't work out so well.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting we overthrow anybody.
Israel's an interesting one because when they first started out, nobody gave a fuck about them. Nobody was on their side. So, I mean, since we're talking about Israel, the Grey Wolves totally hate Jews, right? They hate everyone who's not Turks.
Yeah, the Grey Wolves are a bit of a. It's a bit of a weird group, especially now because of their Erdogan elections. I mean, it seems like as the years go by, the Grey Wolves just continue want to evolve from being that sort of militant nature they have and just fully become a just giant political powerhouse in Turkey. And they're doing a pretty decent job at doing it. They have a big following base in Turkey. And I mean, it was founded in the late 1960s, and it was an armed extension of the MHP. And today it's one of the biggest political groups there. They also obviously have a lot of, racist ideals against the Kurds. They do also criticize Israel quite a lot. They themselves deny their anti-Semitism, but obviously from their own values, you can kind of draw where that comes from. But yeah, I think the main thing is that Kurdishophobia that they have. The Grey Wolves are a pretty hardline group when it comes to having phobias of other ethnicities. They deny the Armenian genocide.
The government doesn't recognize it either, so yeah. Why should they? If you're the fascist group, why are you going to recognize it?
Yeah, but the Grey Wolves, they're a very interesting group to me also because, you know, this is more of an informal observation, but, you know, they themselves consider themselves to be very, let's say, borderline fascist group in Turkey. Usually when you think of a fascist group and you see the violence they do, you expect them to be very, very big guys who do a lot of violence. And there's multiple incidents. You can find it online of Grey Wolves being attacked by Kurdish groups in Turkey. And you can see them sort of like running away or retreating. And I think this year there was actually an incident where the MHKP the MHKP. Anyway, it's a Kurdish group based in Istanbul. And they confronted these Grey Wolves in the street and started throwing bottles at them. And you can see the Grey Wolves retreating. And so there's actually constant clashes in Turkey between Kurdish groups and the Grey Wolves. And the Grey Wolves specifically target Kurdish communities. But then, obviously, as you mentioned, they have a big, big sort of disapproval, if I can word it that way, of the Armenians and Jews as well.
Their rhetoric is very interesting because a lot of it is like, quote unquote, traditional fascist, like ethno-nationalist rhetoric mixed in with Islamist rhetoric. And it's very weird because they basically hate any group of Muslims that aren't Turkish. Like they hate Syrians. They hate Kurdish people.
Here's a map of people they tolerate.
Oh, wow. The map just loaded. That's a big map. If I'm not mistaken, those are the Turkic communities, are they not?
These are the people they tolerate.
Yeah, these are the people basically all the
that
Turkic.
Makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Sorry, I misunderstood that.
It's just, Turkish language map. I pulled up a Turkish language map for the joke, so.
Ah, okay. No, that makes more sense. No, but I could have been accurate. I would have believed you if you said those are the people they actually tolerate. You know, we often assume that the Grey Wolves don't even attack other Islamic sort of entities, but they do. When we're talking about their ideologies, they're Turkish supremacists. For example, one of the biggest acts of violence they committed was the Marash massacre. And they killed over 100 Alevis people. The Alevis is like a regional Islamic group in central Turkey, and they killed over 100 of them. People often mistake the Turkic identity with also the broader Islamic identity. And so when many people start covering the Grey Wolves and what they do, they assume that they have this sympathy towards other Islamic movements. That's not really the case. It's not really appropriate to narrow it down to just an Islamic sort of preference. I think the map you showed, as much as it was a joke, was very, very valid, John. I think when you ask them who they value, it would quite literally be only Turkic individuals. They have that really big feeling of supremacy about their ancestry.
And I find what you brought up about the massacre of Alevi Turks to be just like, again, it just shows how like kind of, I guess you could say, supremacist their thoughts and their actions are. Because it's like, if you were to go to these like regions of southern Turkey and ask your average like Alevi Turk, like, how do you feel about being Turkish? They would probably say something like, oh, I'm very proud of being Turkish. Like, I'm very patriotic. And it's just like, but for them, it's, you know, they're the wrong
for them,
type
it's, yeah,
of
it's
Turk.
Even more of a question than governments or country. It's really completely about that ethno-nationalism.
Right. So someone I do want to get into here is, as far as the Grey Wolves go, is a guy, I hope I'm saying his name right. I don't know how that C in Turkish is supposed to be pronounced, but Abdullah Çatlı or Katli.
Yeah.
And he was a hitman basically for the Turkish MIT. And he was also a drug trafficker. And he was at one point the leader of the Grey Wolves. What have you heard about him? What have you seen about him?
Well, when we were researching on him, we couldn't help but notice a sort of resemblance with Gavrilo Princip, the because of the mustache. I think it's a bit of a resemblance that you can see. But yeah, like you said, he led the Grey Wolves. He was considered a bit like the hitman, like the contract killer for the MIT. Man, just bad guy overall. You know, when, no matter if you agree with the Grey Wolves or not, obviously he's a contract killer. Just somewhat of a bad guy overall. He was, yeah, I mean, we were talking about who they dislike. He killed multiple people of the PKK. He also killed many people from the, was it the Armenian? It was either the Armenian police or the Armenian sort of secret army. The Asala. I'm not quite sure how that translates in English. So apologies for that. But he did kill Kurds and Armenians. So yeah.
This is Abdullah Çatlı, by the way.
On the left, yeah.
Yeah, on the left.
Well, that was when he was young, I guess, on the left.
Because I believe he died in the 90s. So that photo looks a little too high resolution to be from the 90s, but I could be wrong. One thing I did want to ask, is it true that the Grey Wolves have their origins as like a youth branch of the MHP?
That's absolutely correct. The guy that founded them was the Colonel Aparslan Türkes in the late 1960s. And it was an armed extension of the MHP, but it was mostly preparing on like training hundreds. I think it was hundreds. It was probably hundreds of youth members. They were training them and educating them in camps that would make them like the youth fighters of the MHP. Since then, they've evolved a lot. You know, like I mentioned at the start, their ambitions are to become a full-blown political party in Turkey with a lot of influence. We see that more and more. I mean, you know, if you think about it, very youth fighters who was an extension of the MHP, and now you have them as a political party. I think that reveals a lot as well about what the group is about.
What was their relationship like with the Turkish president Kenan Evren's military government in the 80s? Were they tolerated? Were they, you know, sort of supported, or were they just kind of left to do whatever? Like, how was that relationship like? Because there's a lot of analysis right now between,
for sure,
Erdogan and his relationship with them and how he's aligned with the MHP in the past. So I was kind of curious, because Kenan Evren's government is kind of like, ideologically at least, the exact opposite, or mostly the opposite of what I would imagine Erdogan's like AK Party is like. So I was just wondering how their relationship may have been like with Evren's military government back then.
Yeah, you know, it's the relationship of the Grey Wolves with that in the 1980s is a bit like a fairy tale start and a terrible finish. At the very start, they had the support. I'm pretty sure even the protection. So like in cases where there was escalated tensions, they would have even the protection from the Turkish army's, the special warfare department, that's what they called it. And so with that Turkish military behind them, the Grey Wolves basically became like a death squad, and they could operate without legal constraints. They could essentially do whatever they liked, and they would have, like I said, the protection of the Turkish government. And so in that time, they gained a lot of influence, did a lot of stuff, did a lot of activities as well, campaigning activities. But then towards the end of the 1980s, they started warring with left-wing groups. And so the Turkish government's special warfare department didn't really approve of that as much anymore. They were like, well, you know, we're supporting you, but now you're fighting back against our own people. They started fighting between left-wing groups in Turkey just because they were supporting certain Kurdish movements or stuff. And so then it became so intense. The Turkish military intervened, kind of distanced themselves from it. And the Grey Wolves retaliated by planning a coup d'etat against that. And so then there was the military takeover, which is what we were talking about. And then the Grey Wolves were completely banned in Turkey. So they couldn't do anything until around a decade later. I think maybe it was like 15 or 16 years later. They couldn't do anything because they were banned. And so that was mostly in the 1980s.
One thing I kind of did want to get into is how much their reach and sort of their influence, and I guess you could say like the you know the Grey Wolf salute has how far it's made it. For example, yeah,
this is their like welcoming.
Yeah, role, yeah. You'll see. Which by the way, that apparently has been banned in Austria.
Well, I'm in Austria, so terrible thing to be doing.
It was banned 4 years ago, apparently. But and in 2020, sense, yeah. the group was banned from France. So oftentimes people will point out that when you look at a lot of fighters in Azerbaijan or even like Syrian Islamist fighters, Libyan Islamist fighters who are aligned with Turkey, they will often do that like little, you know, wolf salute. And that's, I think, just kind of like a good sort of like capsule of how influential they may be. Just even if like a guy throwing this sign up in Syria doesn't even really know what that means, or he doesn't really know much about the Grey Wolves, he'll throw it up anyway because he associates it with some sort of ally. The other thing I wanted to get into, I was wondering if you knew about this, because it was like a big Balkan Insight article when it came out, and I do have it pulled up right now, was that they did find a Grey Wolf cell had actually been established in Bosnia.
That just reveals how international their influence is. I mean,
right.
That really can't be understated. They have, I mean, the one in Bosnia was a cell, I suppose, whereas they mostly have partnerships. They have a lot of partnerships. So that's why you see the spread of their salutes of that little call sign that was on the screen.
That was Hulk Hogan and Dennis Rodman doing it. That's how far it spread, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like it's like what Ace said, you know, many of the times it's just kind of like a hard rock punk sign and people have no idea what that is correlated to that, but it's part of their soft power, you know, people do it without thinking about it. And then, but
right,
I mean, they do have alliances with groups in, I mean, it ranges from kind of everywhere. They have with political groups in Russia, in Syria, Western Europe, even Greece, if you can believe that. And the thing is, what's interesting is that sort of inconsistency. I mean, we talked about their attacks against Islamic groups in the 70s. But then they have some partnerships with some Muslim identity groups. So, for example, you see some pro-Chechen alliances with the Great Unity Party. So they have that weird ambiguous feel to their ideology, but they're definitely super international. People often mistake it as like, oh, you know, it's like Turkish problem, Turkish fascists. But it's very, I mean, there's a reason as to why, you know, what you said, Ace, that the Austrian government, I suppose, banned the thing. It's there's a lot of Turkish migrants, most of them came for economic benefits as well throughout Europe. When I lived in Germany, I lived in Bonn, which is near Cologne, and there's this one park called Bad Godesberg, which has an incredibly high number of Turks. And so, you know, there's then that we kind of see that with most, let's say, movements of migrants in the world. You see that development of then, well, they make their own political movements abroad. And so the Grey Wolves have definitely succeeded at doing that.
Right. And I think something that's often forgotten when we talk about like Turkish migration into Europe is that with those like Turkish migrants, there were a lot of, you know, Kurds from Turkey. So people of Kurdish descent who came along with them. And if anything, it's kind of smart on part of these like governments to sort of ban these things just because, you know, it can cause unnecessary provocations, which can turn one thing into another. And we know how fighting works. Like people can get mad.
Sure, for sure. Absolutely. So
let's transition to the last one here that goes back to the 16th century. I don't know much about this.
This is actually, I'm kind of glad, John, that you mentioned it goes back that far, because that is something I wanted to ask you, is that when you look into like the Mapuche movements in Chile, the thing that often comes to mind is things that'll come up a lot is they'll talk about like different uprisings that the Mapuche people led in like the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s. And when you're dealing with like the Americas, you know, they're all in some form or another, some kind of like colonial state. So would you say like the current Mapuche movements are like organized into like a single group, or would you say it's more so protest movements for like just kind of the general like interests of the Mapuche people?
So the Mapuche would be even older than what you guys think. There's evidence from what archaeologists think that Mapuche culture, as we know it, or some variations of it, date back to like 500 BC. Like it's a very, very old culture of people, and a beautiful one as well. When you research it, they have really absolutely incredible, an absolutely incredible culture. But if we're looking at the movements today that represent the Mapuche culture, there are specific groups that actually operate on behalf of the Mapuche. So, you know, usually when you type it online as well, if you type like, let's say Mapuche conflict or so, you'll see names here and there, but most of the time people refer to broad protest organizations or just the general ideology of the Mapuche people and their liberation sort of, you know, like, or their rights. But there are very specific groups who act independently and they're armed as well. And they're completely illegal in Chile. They're usually in the Arauco, Mayeco regions, so sort of central Chile, where the Mapuche can be traced back to. And I think the main two, you can look at the Weichan Auku Mapu. So people, yeah, quite tough names to remember, but it's the WAM, the WAM. And then you have the Coordinadora Arauco Mayeco, which is the CAM. And so those are the two biggest groups that sort of represent the Mapuche in Chile. They're both insurgencies. They operate mostly in Biobío, and then, like I said, Arauco, but also Los Ríos, so different regions in Chile. And what's interesting is they've been active since, let's say, one of them since just before the 2000s, and the other one since, let's say, 2011. So, yeah, here you have a picture of the CAM. They've been active since around, like, 1998, let's say, maybe 99, as an actual insurgency. And then if you look at the WAM, they would be active since 2010 or so. But the actual culture dates all the way back. And so that's why it's possibly like the one type of struggle you should put in the definition of underreported. I mean, a lot of the people have briefly heard of the Mapuche conflict and even
I've
less.
Seen the, I've seen the flag before. That's all. That's yeah. all I really know about it is I've seen yeah. the flag.
Hey, all bias aside, it's a badass flag. And, you know, it's really interesting how these groups operate because they have that mix of jungle warfare, that sort of guerrilla warfare, and at the same time they have that their political organization side to it. Really, really interesting stuff. But the Chilean government really disapproves of it. Very hard crackdown. There's been military literally like entirely new military operations. So for example, in France, after the terrorist attacks in 2015 and 17, you had Operation Sentinelle, where like you have like police officers armed walking through the streets of Paris. You kind of have that in Chile for the Mapuche. So they have their own special military units who go into the jungle and specifically look for WAM camp fighters to fight them and crack down on what they view are like Mapuche terrorists, quote unquote. So they take it very, very seriously, huge crackdown. And actually it's illegal in Chile to have a contact in the Mapuche guerrilla groups. So just having a contact with one of these people is very dangerous. I think it's also worth noting that the main way that these groups are organized, I mean, you know, the Mapuche you can think are one people. So how come there's multiple groups? The reason being is they're very focused around that sort of, not necessarily factionalism, but they operate within their smaller groups within Mapuche territory. You know, the Mapuche people is
they're,
a huge community.
They're more confederalist, tribal confederalist based.
In a way. I think that's a valid way to put it. And it's a very big region in Chile, a very, very big. I think if you combine the three regions that I put, that's a big proportion, obviously not the majority, but still a significant proportion of the country. And so it would be almost impossible for there to be one unified group. So they operate in small cells. Obviously now, since the crackdown of the government, it's also just easier to get away with things if you're multiple different, if you're smaller scale.
When you do look into this like conflict, you find out that the Mapuche are generally... Or Mapuche, is Mapuche the right way to say it?
Yeah, Mapuche, right. Mapuche,
right. So it's like they're generally very economically disadvantaged, and they do live in like a lot of overcrowded areas. They don't really have a lot of access to clean water or electricity in a lot of these places that they live in, and a lot of Mapuche elders don't even like really like speak Spanish. A lot of like older people in the Mapuche community, they. Like, which is the official language of Chile. The thing I did want to ask you is it seems like kind of going back to how the natural resources don't get invested into the areas they come from is that a big point of contention for them, and rightfully so, is that Chilean forestry companies tend to exploit their traditional forest lands, and they're involved in the logging business. And obviously this business does contribute heavily to the economy and GDP of Chile, but not so much to the economic benefit of the regions that are mostly populated by the Mapuche, which is where they're sourcing a lot of this logging and, you know, forestry operations. So two things I did want to ask you: have any Mapuche armed groups gotten involved in the illegal logging trade in order to fund their operations? And the second question was kind of similar to my question about West Papua: have they targeted any of these companies? Have they targeted any of their logging infrastructure, things like that?
So I'm going to have a very unique way of answering this. I think, I promise it'll make sense when I get to it, but I think the best, like, most interesting way I can describe it is if I take you on a story on why we call Manhattan in the US, Manhattan. I promise this will make sense in the end. When settlers arrived in what today we know as like the United States, settlers wanted to buy New York, or what we know as Manhattan. They wanted to buy the Manhattan region to native, let's say, Indians. And obviously, the native Indians didn't have that concept of buying land. They didn't understand it. They were like, you can't just buy land. That makes no sense. So they offered a very low price. They got money from the settlers, and they actually laughed at them for, you know, thinking that you can just buy land, because that wasn't something they conceived to be possible. And Manhattan in their language means white man. And that's the same word they would use to describe crazy people. So actually, native Indians had that such a completely different understanding of how land works, that when the settlers wanted to buy Manhattan, they called them crazy white people, and they associated that, you know, those two words together. And so then the settlers, kind of to mock them, called Manhattan Manhattan. So the reason as to why I'm mentioning that is exactly because of what you're saying, of the way these different cultures perceive land ownership. They perceive the respect towards the environment around us. The Mapuche specifically, in their approach to resistance, are entirely based around the preservation and the support of their territories. So unlike other groups that tend to get involved in, let's say, illegal logging, illegal mining, the Mapuche do the complete opposite. They have these entire operations. They call them Organos de Resistencia Territorial, which in English just means territorial resistance organs. And they will take up land or sort of, you know, places that are, let's, like, forestry infrastructure, basically, where the government was planning on doing logging. And what they will do, especially the CAM has been the most active in doing this, is they're not only going to burn the transport trucks, they're not only going to destroy the offices, they're going to sabotage all the sort of plantations for logging and stuff. But after that, they're going to take control of the territory and regrow everything there. That is something insanely fascinating to me. The way that they have that approach to resistance is to show that sort of, you know, like, sort of confrontation to the government almost. And they see it as recuperaciones productivas, which in English just means productive recuperations. So it's a way of occupying the land and utilizing it at the same time. So all the land that they capture, they view it as a true gift, because they're not going to do any illegal mining, illegal logging. They're going to start basically preparing it for the plantation of different crops. They're going to use it in a very sustainable way. They're going to use it for agriculture, for plantation. And that's honestly something that's incredibly fascinating about the Mapuche, especially the CAM and the WAM, because they both do this. That's just something incredible.
So it would just be kind of like against their principles to really like retake somewhere where there may have been like a forestry or like logging operation.
Absolutely.
And use that to fund themselves. That's actually really cool. I think that's like that's pretty like noble and honorable in a lot of ways. That's like very principled for them to do. Yeah.
But very, very interesting. And yeah, when you see most of the Mapuche guerrilla groups, they're very similar in that understanding of, we don't believe in private ownership of land that much. They don't necessarily believe in the, let's say, the dynamics of it all. And so usually when they do that approach to resistance, the way they combat it is they try and defy that status quo, which they view as sort of like a westernization of territory. That's the way they call it.
You want to plug some of your stuff?
Sure. I mean, first, I'd like to thank you guys, obviously, for inviting me. Great conversation. Also, thanks for your support. Your pages are great. So the first thing I want to plug is more of the content that you guys do.
We do a lot of dumb shit on YouTube right now, too, just to try and, like, we're trying to, like, just boost our views. because YouTube wants you to post constantly.
So we're gonna pull a bait and switch on YouTube. We're gonna like lure people in with dumb content, and then we're just gonna like slam them with information.
But yeah, otherwise, if you're interested in seeing more rebel groups, seeing more content on rebel groups, more insurgencies, we make scholarly content on our website, moderninsurgent.org. You can find us on Instagram at moderninsurgent. And yeah, we're on Twitter. And
what's the planned release date for the documentary, man, in Nepal?
Well, for the Nepal documentary, we're not fully sure yet. I think very early July, hopefully. We have a documentary coming out in the next few days on Ultima Generazione, which is an Italian group, a climate change activist group that sort of blocks roads. We interviewed one of their members, so we'll be making a bit of a report on that. The Nepal documentary is our first on the ground one, so I really want to edit it to like perfection. So let's say early July, and I think I just have to work on it even more.